Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Cover. This is our first in 2016. I'm going to be hosting this by myself. Jeff is off actually interviewing Terry Brooks right now up in his hometown, Seattle, for an event. So what we thought we'd do today is kick off 2016 in a very special way. We interviewed a couple authors, best-selling authors, Robert Crace and Craig Johnson. Jeff did those. And we're going to play those for you here on the air tonight. We'll be back with our normal show next Monday, Martin Luther King Day. And Jeff and I will be back. More reviews, more things. We have a couple surprises in store for you, so make sure you check that out. We also want to remind you, of course, that every show here on Suspense Radio this year is brought to you by Kensington Books. So make sure you go to kensingtonbooks.com for more information on all the stuff that they have going on in publishing here in 2016, stuff they have done before 2015. Of course, we've had a couple other authors on. Kevin O'Brien was one that we just had on not too long ago. Lisa Jackson we've had in the magazine many times, and so on and so forth. Kensington is a great publisher. Make sure you check that out. Also, go to darkrenaissance.com for more information on their books. If you like ghouls and zombies and things a little on the edge, they're a great resource for books that they have coming out in 2016, along with a new publisher, CrookedLaneBooks.com. We had Lee Adams on the show on Saturday for Inside Edition and talked with her, and Crooked Lane Books is another great publisher. Revel Books has some good books coming out here in 2016. This is the year of the publisher. What I like to say is you have to make sure that you check out who the publisher is. Very, very important. Along with the author, because it's the publisher that is the front before you even get the book. And when you can go out and publish books in your Kindle and they haven't been through the process, you definitely want to make sure that you get a publisher that takes books through the process so you know that they've been vetted and actually edited, because that's a big problem with self-published authors. But let's hit it right now with our late first interview, Robert Crace. Again, speaking with Jeff Ayers, and we're just going to run right through these interviews and no break in between. So you're going to hear Robert Crace interview first, and then we'll go in right to Craig Johnson, of course, best-selling author of Longmire, so you hear him next. And here we go with Robert Crace, Jeff Ayers.
Hi, this is Jeff Ayers for Beyond the Cover, and today I get the awesome pleasure of talking to Robert Crace, who got his start writing for television, shows like Miami Vice and Beretta, and his first novel was The Devil's Raincoat, which introduced the stellar P.I. Elmer Cole.
Raincoat, Jeff. good start, buddy.
Hey, you sure. I got to tell you how much I love the book. The new book that's out today, we're talking, and thanks for taking time to chat with me, is The Promise. So, Robert, thanks for being on the show.
It's great to be here, Jeff. We're going to have a good time today.
I'm looking forward to this. Well, and you haven't seen my review of this yet, but it should be posted soon, so just letting you know that. And you don't have anything to worry about, promise. So talk about your promise.
Okay, good. Go for that joke. You got it. Ding.
So anyway, yes, talk about The Promise, your new book.
Well, you know, after the after I published Suspect, which was now 2 years ago, and created the star characters of that book, LAPD K-9 officer Scott James and his police service dog Maggie, who's a German Shepherd, I had such a good time writing those characters and felt there was so much more I could get from them that I knew I would have to find a way to have Scott and Maggie cross paths with Elvis and Joe, who are my signature characters. And once I had the story, a believable, credible story, because I just didn't want to jam these four characters together just because, you know, the author wanted to. But once I found the right story so that I could bring them together, it was everything I wanted to be. I wanted to have the pleasure of writing those single book with all those four characters. And the promise is it. For me, that's like being turned loose in Disneyland. It was really a fun experience. I think I ended up with a top-notch thriller.
I did like it, not giving anything away. But one of the things I love...
That's not a secret, Jeff.
One of the things I love is the title is so perfect because all the characters are essentially keeping a promise.
Yeah, that was one of the... There's the crime story aspect of the book, of course. Elvis is hired to marry he's hired to find a missing woman, single mom, whose son was a victim of a terrorist blast in Nigeria. When he's on the hunt for her, that's when he crosses paths with Scott and Maggie, who are trying to find, who are in the process of searching for a wanted fugitive, a murderer, when they uncover or stumble upon stolen military munitions, which could belong with could be going to a terrorist group. Beyond that, growing out of this woman, Amy Breslin, whose child has been lost, there was such an emotional well involved that seemed to drive Elvis to totally devote himself to helping this woman and saving her. So basically, he finds himself willingly making a series of promises. And each promise he makes is the right thing to do. These are the kinds of things that motivates Elvis. And all the characters find themselves in this situation. It seemed to be underlying the theme of the book, this obligation we have to each other. And that was really the driving engine for the emotional content of the book. At least in Elvis Cole's world, when you give your word, you keep it. And that's what I was exploring in the book.
That's one of the things I love about your books is there's this, you got the thrills going on, you got the action going, you got great characters, but there's an emotional underlying aspect that just makes it rise above a lot of other books out there. I guess, how do you maintain that consistency in the emotional aspect of it?
Well, I write about the things that are important to me. First off, this is my 20th novel. It's the 16th Elvis Cole novel, plus there were four standalone books. The 16 books with the same character is a lot of books, but the way I think of it, he's not really the same character. I wrote The Monkey's Raincoat, and which was published in 1987, so I wrote it in the mid-80s. I'm not the same person I was then. I've changed. We all do. We grow, we evolve, we change. I have that expectation of Elvis. Elvis is impacted by the world around him. He's impacted by the things he lives through, the things he survives, the things he feels. So as Elvis changes, I stay interested in him. I want to know what those changes are. I as the writer, I want to explore those changes. And I guess they reflect the changes in me too. So in a way, Elvis is always fresh for me. I'm not trying to recreate the exact same Elvis Cole that existed or exists in The Monkey's Raincoat. He's older now. He's been through more things. My longtime readers who've read all the books, they've vicariously seen him grow and change over the years. So this is a journey we're on together.
He's definitely less of the wisecracking guy, but he's more of the trustworthy guy, among other things.
Well, you know, it's Elvis can still be funny when he chooses to be, but I think that he doesn't. This is by design on my part. You know, the more recent books tend to be about subjects that are often more difficult to joke about or make light of. You know, when Elvis is there are several scenes in The Promise where Elvis is wisecracking and makes light of things. You know, they're but those are appropriate to those scenes and those characters he's playing off. You know, when you're dealing with a woman who's had her son murdered by lunatic terrorists on the other side of the planet, it's not the time for wisecracks and eye rolls. But that's part of the, I think that's part of the growth, both from the character, but also from the author too, and what I'm choosing to write about, the stories I choose to write.
Well, you did mention bringing back Scott and Maggie, and by the way, thank you for that. Maggie is truly awesome.
Thank you. She's a good dog.
She's a great dog. I'm curious, first of all, I'll ask my question I was going to ask in a moment, but how do you write from a perspective of a dog?
Oh, man. I'll tell you, I didn't wake up one morning and say to myself, Bob, you're going to write from the perspective of a dog. Won't that be fun? That actually evolved out of the enormous amount of research I did into canine cognition, canine behavior, canine perception, when I was sort of ramping slowly up toward writing the suspect, last year's book, and creating the character of Maggie. Again, when I began all that research, I wasn't looking to write a book, and I wasn't, you know, my goal wasn't to create a canine character. I actually began the research simply because I was as part of a grieving process for my having lost my dog. So it was pure personal interest that led me down that path. But what I found was that those subjects were enormously fascinating to me. You know, the whole notion of why and how humans and dogs bond. You know, what's the nature of the relationship between humans and dogs? You know, how primitive canids became domesticated, and what was the likely evolutionary path that led to domestication, and that sort of codependence we have with dogs. Dog perception. I could go on and on because I am fascinated by this stuff. But little by little, As I learned all this hard science, you know, this actual information about how dogs think and how they see and perceive the world around them, I began to think, man, this stuff is so great. It would make a terrific character. I'd love to write about, you know, a dog, or, you know, this relationship, a canine handler and a dog, and a dog partner. But little by little, I was so saturated and fascinated by this information, by the world of the dogs, that when I finally knew that I was going to create Canine Maggie, the German Shepherd, I had a really sound, solid notion of how dogs think and what it's like. And then the real test wasn't what's going on in the dog's head. It's how do I present it? Because it was very, very important to me not to anthropomorphize the dog. I didn't want to do Scooby-Doo.
Right.
I didn't want to do one of these, kind of like thinly veiled, you know, human cartoon dog creations. You know, here's the dog talking. Here's the dog smoking a cigar. You know, here's, Scott, it's a little sexy with his girlfriend. Here's the cut to the dog rolling the eyes, you know, covering his head with his paws. I didn't want to do that. I wanted Maggie to be real. So by the time I wrote her, it was actually really natural to slip into her head and how she would see the world.
That's great. And I would argue that Suspect's your best book, just because you did such an amazing job creating such a realistic character with her as well as with Scott.
Thanks. I mean, I'm proud of all the books, but Suspect was special. It was, for me, you know, it was a very emotional, moving book for me to write, in large part because of the purity of Maggie. That's one of the appeals to me, that the purity that dogs have. You know, there's no guile, there's no manipulation or subterfuge on the part of the dog. What you see is what you get, and their devotion and loyalty is paramount. And I wanted to, I guess you can tell from the things I'm saying, I just fell so much in love with her, and I wanted to bring her back. And I wanted to relive those types of moments in another story, and that's why I wrote The Cross, because Maggie's in there, and I get to dig into her nature and character even more.
And it was so nice to have her back. One thing I've noticed with you, though, is when you do standalones, you tend to incorporate them into Pike and Cole's world.
Yes.
That was Demolition Angel as well.
Yeah, all of them. The problem I have, if it's a problem, Jeff, is, you know, I go into these things as standalone books. There's just like, you know, a character I want to write about, or a world, or something I want to write about. But I tend to fall in love with my characters. I did it with, as you said, Demolition Angel with Carol Starkey. She ended up being a part of the Ellis Cole books for several of the books. And then with Suspect. I was halfway through the writing of Suspect. I wasn't even close to finishing yet. And I just knew that this girl's a keeper. You know, I would have to write about her again. So, you know, I brought her into Ellis Cole's Los Angeles. In The Promise, and in the future, no doubt there will be more Scott and Maggie standalones.
Okay. Well, I look forward to anything you write. No, I have never forgiven you for breaking up Elvis with his girlfriend. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, Lucy Chenier?
Yes.
Hey, well, hey, Jeff, don't be too quick on the trigger there, buddy. I mean, I'm no promises here, but in Elvis Cole's Los Angeles, all things are possible. Lucy might just, she might return at some point.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna hold you to that.
Don't hold me. Don't hold me. No promises, but I'm just saying. just saying, Jeff. Just for you.
All right. Well, thank you. So we've been talking about Elvis and Joe Pike a bit. I'm going to throw a hypothetical at you.
Sure.
And also, I'm trying to give you questions that I know you're not going to be getting over the course of the day, because I know you're getting swamped with interviews and ask the same questions. So, hypothetically, how could Joe and Elvis betray their trust in each other?
Oh, man. Well, here's the thing. Now, by definition, like, you asked me that question, and the hair on the back of my neck stands up. It's like, I want to slap leather and start sending rounds downrange after Jeff for even suggesting that such a thing is possible.
That's why I said hypothetically.
But you know, hypothetically would be, would I be a good enough writer to create the illusion that was happening in you, the reader, even though I know as the writer that could, in fact, never happen. In other words,
yeah,
it might appear that they had violated, that one had violated the other's trust, but see, I think there's no way that would ever happen. I think either man would die first. So
I'm thinking exactly the same thing. So that's why I wanted to ask you that.
It might appear at first blush that this is what's happening. And in fact, you know, whoever was on the receive, whichever character was on the receiving end of that, might even at first think that was the case, but ultimately it would have to turn out that no trust was violated. In fact, just the opposite was happening.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, and now, Jeff, okay, I'm going to curse you for this, but I'm starting to think, oh man, maybe I should, that could be a book I write one day. I can figure out the right angle. I'm going to blame Jeff on that.
Oh, well, thanks. Sorry, I guess.
You're going to torture me for a year and a half, Jeff. I'll just be like you, slaving over this thing.
And Maggie will appear, and I'll be happy. It'll all be good. One of the things that I want to know other authors talk about aging their characters.
Yeah.
I don't. What? You don't.
No.
When did you make that decision and why?
Well, the why part is easy. The why part is because my guys are physical guys. I enjoy that about them. You know the action sequences, the physicality of them. I like putting them nose to nose with bad guys in a physical, confrontive way. And so it you know, I reached a place because in fact, Elvis and Joe are sort of anchored in time by the earlier books, which established that Elvis and Joe are both Vietnam veterans. And I get emailed about this all the time.
Oh, I'm sure you do.
Because if you were you know, time is passing now If they aged as you and I actually age, they're getting to a place in their lives where things would be physically, they'd be slowing down. They'd be, you know, the aches, the pains, showing the wear and tear. And if I were to treat their age accurately, I would have to reflect that in the books. And I so enjoy, not only as the writer, but as a reader too, I enjoy those scenes of physicality that's going to require them to stay in the physical game longer than they could in real time. So I began to let their ages slip and slide about 7 or 8 books ago. They're not aging as fast as the rest of us. A year in my life isn't really a year in Elvis Cole's life anymore. So I have to, and I get questions all the time. Oh, you know, aren't these guys 70 years old now, or whatever the case? And the answer is no, they're not. They're going to be like permanently somewhere in their 40s, because I like them to. I like the potential of moving them in whatever direction I want, so I have to cheat that.
And you don't want them hitting some gunman with a walker down the road, too. So.
No, you know, it's not sexy, right? I mean, Joe Pike is like a perpetual, the ultimate badass. And, you know, to have him... doddering around in a walker or unable to move because, you know, I'm the guy, you know, like, my knees hurt, my ankles hurt, everything's breaking down. But I'm a writer guy who sits in a chair all day. Joe Pike is a man of action, and so is Elvis Cole. I don't want to sit in a chair all day.
Oh, yeah, I get that, and thank you for that, actually.
I'm just being honest with you.
This is good. You have never, as far as I know, optioned the rights to the characters for film or TV.
Correct.
Why? We know you've optioned other.
Yeah,
you had a movie made.
Standalone books have all either sold or in option or under option for films, and I'm fine with that. But there's something about Elvis and Joel, and it's a very complicated answer, and I don't want to belabor all the different points, but it gets down to this. Elvis and Joel, my life's work. They're like this thing I share with my readers, my readership. And I actually really believe, because books are a collaborative medium. A lot of people don't realize that, but they are different from film and TV. What the book? Book is paper with some ink smudges on it, and it just sits there inert on a shelf. The book and whatever is within that book really doesn't exist until a reader picks it up and reads it. And then something's created in the mind of that reader. That thing, those characters, Elvis and Joe, are collaborations between myself and my readers. And I just don't want to hand them, I don't feel safe handing them over to a film company. This is a highly personal decision on my part. It's not a judgment on the many other, Conway's Bosch is on TV, Amazon and Amazon TV, and he's got this great series going, and I really like the Jack Reacher flick with Tom Cruise. I'm rooting for lead for more films and all that other stuff. But those are like success stories after the fact. To sign off on Elvis and Joe going into the Hollywood Shark Fest, and gosh knows what comes out on the other end. And maybe it has a detrimental impact on my readers and how they perceive Elvis and Joe, or maybe even how I perceive Elvis and Joe, makes my skin crawl. So I want to go there with them, and I've resisted selling the film rights.
No, I actually kind of like that too. I can cast them in my mind with each book, and...
Yeah, and that's what's cool about books, see? For me, you read my book, and you, Jeff, you have your very own special Elvis and Joe, and Scott and Maggie. But you have Elvis and Joe in your head, and you and I have actually collaborated on that creation. Whatever it is you're seeing, you and I have collaborated on that. And it's special to only us because, whatever, all the people who read the books, each reader creates their own Elvis and Joe. And I've helped that reader, I've collaborated with that reader on those creations. And to me, that's a very, very special, intimate act. It's like art. It's why I do this, and it's my great joy and pleasure in doing this. I find it rewarding and fulfilling. That's what's fabulous about books, that no other art form, I think, provides. And so I want to protect that.
So I'm guessing that's why you haven't gone back and written screenplays.
Well, I love movies. And TV, I certainly did enough television over the years when I was a younger writer. But the reason I don't is I'm a novelist. I have the most fun by writing books. Books are how I want to spend my time. To me, though, there are certainly TV series that I'm a rabid fan of, and good movies that interest me. I love watching movies, but I really have no interest in working in those mediums anymore. My medium of choice is the novel, and So time is limited. I want to devote all of my working time into writing more books and telling more stories.
Well, and I'm totally fine with that. Just, you know, last year you won an award. Could you talk a bit about the honor of winning that?
Well, I assume you're talking about the Mystery Writers of America Grandmaster Award.
Yes.
Wow. When I got the call from the MWA board to let me know that they had selected myself and it was also Carolyn Hart, we were each selected as grandmasters that year. I was, you know, it's cliche, but I literally was blown away. That call was so out of so unexpected. It still makes me giggle when I think about it. You know, I have the Edgar here in my office on the shelf, and I'm looking at it right now as we speak, Chuck. And all I can say is I'm not giving it back. I never expected anything like this. I am honored and humbled by it. And now Eddie's up there on the shelf and he's keeping an eye on me and making sure I stay true to my roots.
Well, and it's a very deserving award, absolutely.
Thank you so much.
So my last thing for you is for your readers, how do they find you online?
Oh, I'm everywhere online, Jeff. I'm taking over the internet. well, we have the website, of course, which is robertcrace.com. Also on Facebook, which is Facebook, The Real Robert Crace. And we're moving into Instagram, which I can be found at Robert Crace, at Robert Crace on Instagram. So I'm everywhere. The Facebook community is real active. We tend to post a lot of things there, and at the website, people can sign up for our newsletter, which we've just recently refurbished and powered up with a big Hemi supercharged engine. So we're going to be getting out a lot more newsletters now. But I actually love interacting with my readers. The tour we're kicking off for The Promise will be going around the country. A couple of the tour schedules on the website too. But I love meeting readers and interacting with them and talking. Heck, if I wasn't a writer and on tour for the book, I would be in bookstores anyway because I'm a book lover. So it's my home turf.
Well, I just had this flash. Since you're the real Robert Crace on Facebook, is there a fake Robert Crace?
Oh, there's so many. You wouldn't believe it. So that's why I'm the real Robert Crace. Except no substitute.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you when you're here in Seattle later. And I just wanted to say thank you so much again for taking the time to chat with me. It's been fun.
Jeff, it's always fun. I had a blast with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Hi there. This is Jeff for Beyond the Cover. And today I have the pleasure of talking to Craig Johnson, who is the creator of the award-winning Walt Longmire series. And he's written 12 novels, and actually his new book, Wait for Signs, is a collection of short stories. Craig, thanks for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk a bit about the new book, Wait for Signs. Why a collection of short stories?
That's a really good question, especially for a guy that doesn't consider himself much of a short story writer. It was kind of funny, but the whole thing started one time when we were at the ranch. I've got a little ranch in northern Wyoming, and the nearest town to where I live is a little town called Ucross, which has a population of 25. So we're pretty small up there. But I was sitting there having a cup of coffee, and my second book had been out. I was working on my second book, and The Cold Dish, the first Walt Longmire book, was out. So my wife slid this Cowboys and Indians magazine in front of me and said, you should do that. And it was a call for submissions to the Tony Hillerman Cowboy and Indian short story competition. It was just called the short story that had to have mysterious elements and have cowboys and or Indians involved with it. And since my protagonist was the sheriff of the least populated county of the least populated state of America, my wife thought that might be a good opportunity for me. And I shoved it back to her and I said, well, you know, I'm not a short story writer. And so then I went down to the barn and I was shoveling out the barn, and anybody who's done that kind of work before knows how much free time you have in your mind. And so I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, if you were to write a short story, what would you, what would you write about? So I started formulating this short story, came back up to the house and wrote it in about an hour, gave it to my wife, and my lovely and supportive wife read it and said, well, you're not going to win with that, you know, so and she was right. I mean, it was the first draft, first attempt at a short story, so I went back and did it the same way that I did my novels and just rewrote it until finally, you know, the deadline came along, and I sent the thing off. And to make a long story short, it actually won and appeared in the, I think it was the March 2006 edition of Cowboys and Indians magazine. And, you know, I got around to December the next year, and I thought, you know what, I got about 2,000 or 3,000 people on my website, CraigAllenJohnson.com, and there's a, you know, like a newsletter that I send out. It's called The Post-it. Which is named for the postage that Ruby, the dispatcher, leaves on Walt's door facing, so he knows what he's supposed to do every morning. And I thought, you know, what would be kind of nice to just kind of send this thing out and give it to everybody for Christmas, just a free, you know, short story. So I did. And I don't think I realized how much trouble I was making for myself until the next Christmas rolled around and everybody started writing and saying, when do we get the free Christmas story this year? And I was like, oh no, I haven't written one. So I rapidly sat down, wrote another one. Like, it kind of became tradition, you know, here for about 10 years running. Every Christmas I would send it out at exactly 11:59 Mountain Standard Time. And it was kind of funny because Viking Penguin got in touch with me and said, hey, are you giving away a short story every Christmas? And I said, yeah, I am. Like, and so they said, well, we'll take all of those short stories and put them together and make an anthology. And so they did. Look, we put together 12 short stories. Look, and I continue, you know, putting them out, you know, every Christmas. Even this year, I'll be sending one out. Look, so, you know, people need to go to CraigAllenJohnson.com and sign up for the posted newsletter. But, yeah, they put it out, this last fall, and, a little collection of 12 short stories made the New York Times Best Poems list.
Well, you did mention that, you live near a town of 25 people.
I do. Well, it's 23 today because my wife and I are in Philadelphia. So.
Well, I have to ask because every time I read books that take place in really small towns, there's all these hidden secrets running throughout.
Yeah, it's a lot more dramatic in literature than I think it is in reality. You know, I guess the big drama around our place lately has been that we get a lot of tourists who come in. The book has been translated into about a dozen languages. And then with the advent of the TV show on Netflix and everything, we get a lot of people who come through Ucross and ask my neighbors where exactly it is that I live. And they always ask me, they say, well, do you want us to tell people where you live? And I'm like, if they get all the way to Ucross and they want to try and find me and say hello, then you tell them where I live. It's not a problem.
I've been to Wyoming, and it's beautiful out there. I absolutely loved it. I drove across the state once from Yellowstone over to Devil's Tower and back.
Oh, my. Yeah, that's the pretty part, the northern part there. The southern part, I-80 can be, that's a little rough sometimes. I usually tell when somebody, which part of Wyoming they've been to. Look at whenever somebody says, oh, I've been to Wyoming, all right. Look at them, I'm like, an I-80. But you went to the pretty part up there with Black Hills, and, you know, and Big Horns, the Big Horn Mountains, and Yellowstone and everything. That's a beautiful area anywhere in the world.
Let's ask about the character of Walt Longmire. How did you come up with his character?
You know, he was kind of a construct in the sense that about 12 years ago was that period in time when all the CSI stuff was really, you know, becoming the rage, and still is, for God's sake, you know, where it was all about the forensics and the ballistics and the, you know, the DNA evidence and all of this. And I ran into a DCI investigator one time, and there in Wyoming, where we have one crime lab in the whole state. And I asked him, I said, well, you know, you guys need DNA evidence. How long does it take you to get it? And he didn't pause for a second. Is this a high-profile case? And I said, yeah, let's pretend like it's a high-profile case. And he said, about 9 months. And so I said, well, that's not particularly honest, what they're doing then on television and you know, and in these books and everything. And he goes, no, it's not. He says, it takes money, it takes time, it takes the technology and all that stuff. And he says, it's kind of in high demand, and you know, it doesn't happen in 5 minutes the way they seem to be portraying it. And so I thought, well, What if I wrote a protagonist who was the sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state in America? You know, wouldn't that be interesting? Because it would force me to kind of deal more with, you know, with character, you know, with the people and the place. And I've always found that to be more interesting storytelling than just the technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's follow up a little bit on the setting and the atmosphere that you're able to pull off in these books. It's so vivid, and you really get that feeling of how everything is spread out, I guess. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, the thing is like, you know, I get studs circles when I set a vest and when he says nothing ever happened nowhere. You know, for me, like, that's the real excitement about writing books is, you know, I mean, I basically live in Walt's world. I live up there in northern Wyoming on the Montana border, you know, right there at the base of the Bighorn Mountains and everything. And it's a beautiful place, but it's also a ferocious place, you know, a place of extremes, extreme cold, extreme heat, you know, extreme altitude, you know, I mean, the mountains there go up to 14,000 feet almost, and so it's a place of extremes, you know, and a people sometimes of extremes, too, okay? And that makes them interesting to write about, and an interesting place to write about. I mean, I think if I was writing books about, you know, people driving to work in the same cars and living in the same houses and doing the same jobs, I probably would have quit writing these books about 10 years ago, okay? But it's not like everywhere else, okay? And so for me, that makes it, you know, kind of magic and something worth exploring, hopefully, for the readers.
One of the things, as a writer myself, I'm always told, well, what genre is it? You know, sci-fi, is it mystery, thriller, whatever. I got to ask, you have the same problem.
You know, I hate genres. I hate that. I think the difficulty with it is that it's you know, everybody's always looking to see which pigeonhole they can step you in, because you know, here in the U.S., you know, it's always going to be about the marketing of the book, you know, and the, you know, the publicity for the book. Okay? And so, you know, they're always looking for a way to sell the book. And one of the quickest ways to do that, of course, you know, is to pigeonhole it in one genre or another. And, you know, I think that the best writing tends to come when you're writing in the margins, you know, when you tend to be, on the edges, you know, of any of those genres. Okay? And for me, I don't pay much attention to it. I mean, you know, you could say that they're Westerns. You could say that they're mysteries. You could say that they're, you know, literary fiction. You could say all these different things. You could say they're humor, you know, but it doesn't really matter. I mean, all it really comes down to is there are only two types of genre. There's good writing and then there's bad writing. That's why you try and avoid the bad part and try and emphasize the good, I think is the difficulty in the job.
Well, how do you maintain the consistency and the growth of the characters throughout?
Well, I think it's one of those things where you really kind of have to pay attention. You can't go into automatic pilot. I mean, we've all started series of books, you know, where you get about 5 or 6, 7 or 8 books into a series, and all of a sudden it seems like they're, you know, kind of recirculating, you know, the plots, you know, the characters don't seem to be developing or evolving, you know, and that's a safe thing to do. I mean, I think a lot of authors get trapped by their own success. You know, they have a book that's their breakout book, and, you know, they just want to write that formula, and certainly the publishers want them to write that formula over and over and over again. But that would just be my idea of hell, I got to admit, you know, just to have to, you know, keep regurgitating that same book over and over again. So for me, you know, it's always going to be a situation that's like, you know, well, what can I do that's different this time? And what issues can I take on this time? Okay? And what can I challenge the characters with this time? You know, and how can I inform the readers and challenge them at the same time? I think it's, you know, it's a challenge and it's always going to be there, but you just have to be ready to tee it up, you know, and play each book, you know, one at a time. Sounds like a bad sports analogy, but it's true. I think you have to, you know, really go after it every single book. You can't, you know, just rest on your laurels, you know, and just, you know, snooze one in. You got to be careful and stay on the job.
Well, have you thought about actually writing a novel that's not a Walt?
Oh, yeah, I have. Like, I've actually even started a few. I've got a literary fiction piece that I've got started, a psychological thriller that I've got started, a historical that I've got started, you know, but it's kind of tough, like, because I have to admit that, you know, being with Viking Penguin, you know, a literary press, like, they're really wonderful about letting me do whatever it is that I want to do, however I want to do it. You know, most of the time, they don't even know what the books are about until I turn in the first draft. You know, after like 12 years, you know, I've kind of earned a little bit of credibility as far as like them trusting me. But I think they're just a magnificent press, and they really, you know, once you, you know, show them that you can do what you can do, like they really don't put any kind of pressures on you. You know, there are a lot of mystery presses out there. They want a body on the ground in the first two pages. They want 10 suspects by chapter two. You know, they've got a formula, you know, that they work with. And, you know, Viking Penguin doesn't do that. You know, they let me do whatever it is I want to do, however I want to do it. And that's a lot of freedom, you know, to have, to go in any direction it is that I want to go in, explore any kind of social issues or personal issues or anything else, you know, that I might feel, you know, be worthy of writing a book about.
Well, that's fantastic. A lot of authors couldn't say that. That's wonderful to hear, actually. I want to ask about the path to your first publication. You write Cold Dish. How did you get it published? How did you track an agent or any of that stuff?
This is really a horrible story. It's actually a good one, too, because I actually had a friend like that who made some phone calls for me. Like, she's a producer out in Los Angeles, and she called up a couple of different agents and said, "Look, I've got this friend. He's a cowboy, you know, from up northern Wyoming. Like, he's got this book that he's written about a Wyoming sheriff, you know. And if you wouldn't mind him stopping by and dropping off a manuscript, I'd really appreciate it." And, well, you know, it sounds a lot better than it was. I mean, you know, most of the time it was me walking up, you know, four stories, you know, and them opening up the door exactly 6 inches, just, you know, large enough for me to squeeze the manuscript through. And it was like out of a Damon Runyon novel, where the cigar smoke would go up over the transom, and I'd hear his voice say, "Sure, kid, we'll let you know." And I'm still waiting to hear from some of them. And, but then there was one where this one agent, you know, she actually gave me like a half an hour of her time, half an hour, 45 minutes of her time to just sit down and talk about the book and about me and about writing. And I didn't know it at the time, but she was actually the president of the agents union there in New York. And maybe if I'd known how big of an agent she was, I might have chickened out with it. But I stayed there, and she actually read the book, and she picked it up and said, "Don't give this to anybody else, I want it." And she's the one that passed it over to Catherine Court, the president of Penguin, and she became my agent over there, and Viking Penguin picked up the book. And they were actually the first ones to say to me, they said, "You know, we think you should think about doing this as a series." And I, without the knowledge of even having had one book published, started arguing with the president of Penguin, saying, "I don't really think that'll work. I've got some better ideas I want to bounce off of you." And she said, "Why don't you go home and think about this in Wyoming?" And I did, you know. And then the big question was, well, do these characters have, you know, more stories to tell? And the answer came roaring back that, yeah, I think that they did. And every day the emails come in, and you know, the response, you know, to, you know, not only the book, but the television show and everything, you know, pretty much convinced me that she was right and I was wrong.
Well, how did the show come about?
You know what? It was the same kind of Cinderella deal as I had, you know, in finding a publisher. Like that, after about 7 books, Warner Brothers got in touch with me and said, "Hey, we're thinking about making a you know, a television show out of your books." It was a package deal, so it wasn't like a blind option, you know, which meant Warner Brothers was actually putting up a lot of the backing, you know, for the series. Like, and I actually got to meet the producers and directors and writers and everybody before I signed on the dotted line, which is really a nice advantage to have, because, you know, you don't know where these things are going to go. An awful lot of times you'll hear authors say, "Oh, my book's got optioned by Hollywood." Well, that really doesn't mean much. It just means that somebody somewhere someday might sometime do, you know, something that, you know, remotely seems like your book. And 9 times out of 10, what happens is it ends up in a manila envelope in somebody's drawer for the next 20 or 30 years, and you get a check. And for me, that really wasn't what I was after. It seemed to me that, you know, the whole idea of the Hollywood connection was just to, you know, provide a visibility for the book. You know, because that's what I am. I'm a cowboy writer in a town of 25. I'm not looking to move to L.A. or move to New York or anything like that. And so for me, it's always going to be about the visibility for the books. And it seems like a TV show, you know, would, you know, have that possibility. I mean, the problem you have nowadays is that, you know, if your book isn't about space vampires, it's probably not going to be a movie that stays, you know, on the screens for very long, because, you know, you're not going to convince 14-year-olds to go see it 18 times. And so, you know, I thought, you know what, maybe a TV show would be a good idea. Like, and so I opted for that, and it turned out to be a really good relationship. I mean, I know you hear a lot of horror stories from authors, you know, in their dealings with Hollywood. But I think it's like any other business. You know, I think that, you know, if you get good people to work with, then, you know, you get a good experience and you get a good product. And if you get, you know, maybe not so great people to work with, then you run into trouble.
It was on A&E for the first 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a bit about hearing it got canceled off the network and then what happened next.
Well, it was kind of a surprise to everybody. Everybody except for the executives at A&E, like, who must have had some kind of an idea of what they were doing. But rapidly what happened afterwards, it pretty much convinced me that they didn't know what they were doing. There was a long story behind it all. Like, what it boils down to is that, you know, Warner Brothers makes the TV show Longmire, and then they license it, you know, to different networks so that they can, you know, broadcast it. And in the 3 years that we were back there at the A&E, like, we were the highest rated scripted drama in their network history ever, pulling in close to 6 million viewers a night. And I think what happened was they decided that they would make a lot more money off of the show if they owned it, rather than, you know, licensing it, you know, from Warner Brothers. So they told Warner Brothers they wanted to buy the show. And Warner Brothers said, you know, well, we've already got this thing sold in 100 countries around the world, and it's your highest rated scripted drama. Why would we sell it to you? And A&E came back and said, well, if you don't sell it to us, you know, we'll cancel it. And Warner's response was, well, you're going to look kind of silly canceling the highest rated scripted drama you ever had. And they did. They surprised everybody by canceling the highest rated scripted drama they ever had. And it rapidly turned into a kind of a PR nightmare for them, like that, because the uproar of people that had, you know, really enjoyed the TV show. I mean, it was a unique situation. At no time had a network, you know, ever canceled its highest rated show. It was kind of strange that they would do that. And so people were very angry about it. And they kind of took to the airwaves, like in the social media, in Facebook and Twitter, and all the blogs and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was an avalanche of bad PR for A&E. And they rapidly figured out that they had a disaster on their hands. And so what they decided to do was put a spin on it and say, oh, well, it wasn't pulling in the proper demographic, the 18 to 49 demographic, and that's why it is that we canceled it. Well, that did nothing but add, you know, throw kerosene on the fire is all that did, because everybody over the age of 49 that was watching the TV show was now three times as mad. And so from what I understand, you know, I mean, I think A&E has lost like about 30% of their audience since they dropped Longmire. And it's gotten to the point where I actually feel sorry for them a little bit, you know, but it wasn't a smart move, and you hate to reward stupid. So anyway, okay, we got picked up by Netflix. It was kind of a scramble around. Like, there were a number of networks that were interested, you know, in picking up Longmire, but boy, the 600-pound gorilla in the room was Netflix. You know, they had all that money, and they were looking to expand their programming, and they knew that there was a demographic there that they had really tapped as well as maybe they should. And so they snagged Longmire as quick as they could, and the fourth season's been trending on Netflix pretty much every night since it was released in September, and they just last week announced that the season 5 was coming up.
I was very excited to hear that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, my mother was, you know, a huge fan, and she ranted to me for hours about how disappointed she was with me. And then she never wanted Netflix. And the second they announced that Longmire was going to Netflix, she calls me and says, okay, you got to help me get Netflix.
Well, I got to admit, it's a pretty wonderful service. I mean, if you can make that reach of $8 a month, you know, I mean, it's pretty great. Look, and the effect that it's had on the TV show is, you know, it's pretty dramatic. You know, whenever, you know, I'm a creative consultant on the show, and what that means is I read the scripts is what I do. I mean, I can't help them with all the things they do as far as Hollywood is concerned, but I'm a writer, and I can kind of help them with the scripts, you know, and I understand the world that they're portraying and the characters that they're portraying, because I was doing it for the better part of a decade, you know, before Warner Brothers got in touch with me. And so it's been interesting because I, you know, would get the scripts, and I would see a really great scene, you know, say between some of the characters, say between Katie Sackhoff and Robert Taylor, and I would be, that's going to be a great scene. I can't wait to see that one. And then I would get the episode, and it would be cut. It wouldn't be there. And I would ask the producers why, and they said, well, because we were long. And we were kind of slaves to that 42 minute basic cable scenario, that format that they have. And since we moved over, I got to make time for those commercials. Like that, they want their pound of flesh. And with Netflix, that's not been the case. I mean, what you actually see are the actual scripts that were filmed, and there isn't any cutting. Like that, and I have yet to see an episode yet that's under an hour long. Like that, and that's just really kind of wonderful to allow the show to kind of unfold and unfurl its wings a little bit and get some room to breathe.
Pretty neat. Are you discovering that people who see the show are discovering your books, or are the most people from your books discovering the TV show? Does that make sense?
No, it's a little bit of it's a combination of both. I mean, a lot of the people that read the books have gone over like that, and now watch the TV show like that. But I mean, it's really hard as an author to reach 6 million people a week. That's kind of tough. Like that, and so. Hollywood does have its advantages. Like I can say quite honestly that the majority of the emails and the majority of the statements that I get at events these days start off with, "I'm really sorry I didn't know about your books, but I found you through the TV show." And I'm always telling people, you don't have to apologize for that. That's okay. You found me. That's the important part.
Yeah, that's true. They found you. I heard about Longmire Days. What is that?
Mm-hmm. Longmire Days is a festival that we have in Buffalo, Wyoming, a little town of 4,000 people up in northern Wyoming at the base of the Bighorn Mountain. An absolutely gorgeous little town that's kind of the basis for Durant, the city that's in the books. And Johnson County is kind of the basis for Absaroka County. And I guess it was a couple of years ago that they asked me to come in and they were going to do Longmire Day. And I came in and signed books, and we had a couple hundred people show up, and I signed books for them and everything. And the Wyoming Office of Tourism asked me and said, well, what do you think the chances are of being able to get the actors, to come to Longmire Days here in Buffalo? And I said, well, I don't know. I could ask. Which ones do you want me to ask? And they said, all of them. And so I did. The very next year, just about all of the actors from the TV show, showed up for Longmire Days, along with about 12,000 of their closest friends. And so the closest thing I can associate it to is that it's something akin to a natural disaster, simply because, all the ATM machines run out of money, all the restaurants and grocery stores run out of food. There's not a hotel room to be had for about 90 miles around like that, but if you get your dibs in early, you can still find a place to stay. It's about that third week, weekend in July, at about 2 weeks after they get through with their production schedule. We always want to give them enough time, the actors, to have a little bit of a breather, but then we don't want to give them enough time that they run off and join another project. And it's turned out to be quite a blast. It really is, because the actors are so very easygoing and very gracious, with their time and their energies, they're just out there walking up and down the street with everybody else. Of course, the highlight for me is the Cowboys versus Indians softball game, where my buddy Marcus Redfender goes around and gets all the best softball players from all the reservations in Montana, and they come down and play the Cowboys. It's kind of like a reenactment of the Little Bighorn is what it is. The poor Cowboys don't stand much of a chance, but it's a great game.
That's pretty neat. What character do you most identify with in your series? And you can't say Walt.
I identify with all of them. I mean, there's little. I mean, when you're what it's like. I mean, you're a writer, so when you're in the room, you're the only one in the room to draw from. So so you have to draw little bits and pieces of yourself out for all those different characters. Then there's none of them that are really me. I think that a lot of times, when you're writing a book, in many ways, it's like conducting a choral group. You're choosing different voices and different characters for specific reasons, to tell a very specific story. And, those have to be well-defined voices. And sometimes they're not specifically your voice, but they are the ones that you need, to be able to tell the story that you want to tell. And that's kind of the way I approach the books, is taking little parts of myself like that, but a lot of parts of a lot of other people too, like that, and then add a large mixture of just plain imagination. And then you get to go work in the fields and toil in the fields of the reader's imagination, which is absolutely the finest place you could ever hope to, going to work in. I absolutely love doing that kind of work. And it's, you know, it's a nice thing because it gives a lot of freedom, you know, to the writer, you know, where, you know, I mean, until Robert Taylor came along and was playing the part of Walt Longmire, you know, you could have had a, you know, courtroom artist go into a, you know, a room and have everybody describe Walt Longmire, and, you know, not a single one of those Walt Longmires would look like anybody else.
Yeah, that's true. And my mom's hoping he's single, by the way.
No comment.
What's next to you?
Let's see. The next book actually is another Walt book. I've got two coming out this year. Let's see. This spring, I've actually got another novella that's coming out. It's something akin to Spirit of Steamboat, a little book that I wrote that was the first state read for the state of Wyoming, the One Book Wyoming Project. And it's called The Highwayman. And it'll be out in the spring. And then I've got another book coming out in the fall, like that, which is the next Walt Longmire novel, which is called An Obvious Fact. And the quote from that is a Sherlock Holmes quote, that there's nothing quite so deceptive as an obvious fact. And it should be a fun book. It takes place in a little town called Hewlett, up in the northeast corner of Wyoming, right next to Devil's Tower, which has a population of 396 and a police force of one. And the problem being that its sister city over in South Dakota, right across the border, is a little town you might have heard of called Sturgis. And they had about 1 million bikers there for the 75th anniversary of the Sturgis rally this last year. And about half those bikers come through and funnel through to go over to Devil's Tower. So imagine a town of 396, you know, with one police officer and half a million bikers. That just seemed like something Walt and Henry should be involved with.
I have a relative that actually goes to that thing every year.
Oh, my gosh. Talk about a natural disaster. Or maybe an unnatural one. I'm not sure.
Where can readers find you online?
Probably the best is, I mean, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, you know, my website is probably the best place to get advanced information like that, and that's craigallenjohnson.com, craigallenjohnson.com, and you can find it on there, and also make sure you sign up for that post-it list, because I do send out a free Christmas story every Christmas Eve at 11:59, Mountain Standard Time.
That's wonderful. Well, it's been awesome talking to you. Thank you so much.